Hello, everyone. This is Bob Seda. My Yamacha radio call sign is N1PLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'm reading for you today in digest form, CQ Magazine, Amateur Radio Communications and Technology, October 2008 issue. The magazine's editor is Richard S. Mosen, call W2VU. QC Magazine is a publication of QC Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Hem System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Hem members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hems may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website is www.handyham.org. Let's first take a look at ham radio news. Georgian hams cut off Russian contacts. The president of the National Association of Radio Amateurs of Georgia has told QRZ.com that Georgian hams are refusing to contact their fellow amateurs in Russia due to the current hostilities between the two countries and are calling on hams worldwide to do the same. The boycott appears to be self-imposed rather than mandated by the government and, in CQ's view, goes against the amateur radio spirit of international goodwill, even, especially, between individual amateurs in countries whose governments are at odds. The Smithsonian Ham Station shuts down. Amateur radio call NN3SI, November 3's. Smithsonian Institute. The ham radio station that has been active from the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. since 1976 is off the air for the foreseeable future. Victim of a major renovation and change of exhibits at the National Museum of American History. The museum has been closed to the public since 2006, and the Information Age exhibit and N3SI's home since 1990 will not be reinstalled, according to the ARRL letter and Newsline. Station trustee John Johnson, W3BE, told Newsline efforts were being made to find an appropriate new location, including inconclusive negotiations to move it to the National Air and Space Museum's new facility in Virginia. For now, says Johnson, the station equipment will remain in storage, but he will maintain the license in hopes of getting the station back on the air in the future. FCC calls for tightening up club trustee transfers. Bill Cross, W3TN, the public face to hams of the FCC's Wireless Telecommunications Bureau, has called on club station call sign administrators to tighten up their procedure for making changes in clubs' licenses. Speaking by phone with the National Conference of Volunteer Examiner Coordinators, many of which are also CSCSAs, Cross said the FCC is getting an increasing number of applications for changing the trustee of a club station submitted by hams who are not authorized to make any changes. According to the ARRL letter, he suggested that the CSCSAs adopt new procedures to assure that the person requesting the change is actually the new club trustee and is acting with the club's authority. Hilberling discontinues PT-8000. German manufacturer Hilberling announced on its website in late July that it was discontinuing production of its high-end PT-8000 transceiver. According to a translation by VA-70J, Victor Alpha 7 Oscar Juliet, the company cited constant design changes required in order to maintain compliance with European Union regulations imposed on manufacturers. While it was possible to achieve compliance in prototypes, the company said that, quoting, guaranteeing this high standard without limitations in a series production program runs into difficulties which cannot be overcome at a cost level, which is still acceptable, close quote. The PT-8000 series was marketed in the United States by Array Solutions. Retail prices varied, depending on features, between $12,000 and $16,000. ARRL establishes LOTW, Logbook of the World, only award. A new ARRL award is the first to require that all confirmations be made via the league's online Logbook of the World database. According to the ARRL letter, the Triple Play Award, which recognizes contacts with all 50 states on voice, code, and digital modes, will be limited to contacts made in January 2009 or later and confirmed via LOTW. Traditional paper QSLs will not be accepted. The ARRL drops the XCC rule on publicly posted logs, saying it is impossible to enforce. The ARRL Board of Directors voted in July to eliminate a rule from the DXCC program that called into question the admissibility of contacts for which the logs of one or both participating stations had been made public. The issue developed with the growing practice of many expeditions of posting their logs online. It came to a head when the CQ Worldwide DX Contest Committee decided to post CQWW logs publicly in an effort to increase transparency and hold contesters more accountable to their peers for maintaining accurate logs. In place of Rule 5, the League Board directed the staff to create resources and best practices guidelines for QSLing. One further ham radio news bit, Tommy Nettle, spelled K-N-E-I-T-E-L, amateur call W4XAA, his ex-call was K2AES, has become a silent key. Radio monitoring icon Tommy Nettle, W4XAA, passed away in Florida on August 22 at age 75. He had been in poor health for the past several years. Tommy was a senior editor and founding editor of our sister magazine, Popular Communications, the grandson of animation pioneer Max Fleischer, and the son of animator Seymour Nettle. Tommy preferred the print media, writing for Popular Electronics and Electronics Illustrated in the 1950s and 60s. He started the Popular Electronics Registered Shortwave Monitor Program, which issued unofficial WPE call signs to active shortwave listeners. His association with CQ began when he became founding editor of S9, a CB magazine started by then CQ publisher Cowan Publishing. When S9 folded, Nettle and a current CQ publisher Dick Ross, K2MGA, launched Popular Communications in 1972. Tommy was editor of PopCom until 1995, when he gave up day-to-day responsibilities for the magazine and became senior editor. He served as an advisor and resource to his successors until illness prevented him from doing so. He was also the author of a multitude of books on CB, scanning, and other radio-related topics. Tommy Nettle, W4XAA, Silent Key. We'll go now to the CQ Magazine editorial, Zero Bias, by author Rick Mosson, W2VU. It's titled 97.1 Sub B. Section 97.1 of the SEC's Rules and Regulations sets forth the basis and purpose of the amateur radio service in the United States. The second item, after public service and emergency communications, is sub B, continuation and extension of the amateur's proven ability to contribute to the advancement of the radio art. Ever since the first commercially built receivers came onto the market in the 1930s, many hams have been worried that we have collectively been losing our edge in the technical arena. The hand-wringing has increased in recent years as transistors replaced tubes, integrated circuits replaced discrete components, and surface mount technology made everything too small to handle without magnifying glasses and special tools. When it comes to building state-of-the-art equipment, the worriers say the average ham is out of his league. In fact, the technical talents of hams today are so often downplayed that the ARRL felt it necessary to focus on them not only in this year's We Do That public relations campaign, but by making technology a fifth pillar of the organization's primary purposes, something that should be obvious to all, but often apparently is not. Regardless of popular perceptions, something curious is happening as we take the next step along the path of technology evolution we've been on since the days of Spark. That next phase of evolution, of course, is digital technology. More and more, our rigs rely on microprocessors and software routines to perform functions traditionally handled by analog circuits and components. The ultimate transition from analog to digital is the software-defined radio, or SDR. We're reviewing one of them, the Flex Radio Flex 5000 Alpha, in this issue. But as noted above, something curious is happening here. Rather than driving another nail into the presumed coffin of amateur radio technical expertise and innovation, the Flex 5000A and the mindset of its designers are opening new doors and creating new opportunities for continuation and extension of the amateur's proven ability to contribute to the advancement of the radio art. Before I explain exactly what I mean, though, I want to back up 25 years or so to the early days of the computer revolution. The common lament in the mid-1980s was that computers were drawing away potential hams and that onerous code test requirements were creating an unreasonable obstacle to otherwise interesting computer types who had little interest in traditional HF hamming, where code knowledge was most important. This theory led to novice enhancement in 1987, the code-free technician license in 1991, and ultimately the removal of all code test requirements last year. There was only one problem with this theory. Even though we made lots of changes to the rules to encourage computer and software folks to join our ranks, little was done to change the technology of ham radio to really entice them to become active hams. To be sure, there have been tremendous strides in making the computer an integral part of most ham shacks and in developing software to enhance our operating logging software, contesting software, digital mode software, including many new digital modes, and station control software all come to mind. But software-savvy hams have been all but shut out of developing and enhancing the software that increasingly determines the features of our radios themselves. This has now changed. Traditionally, amateur radio manufacturers have felt that they were the experts on determining, with customer input, designing, and implementing various features on their models. For many years, they were correct. We're not all engineers, after all. Recently, though, three companies in particular made special efforts to seek out customer input and suggestions. Elcraft, Tentec, and Flex Systems have established very active online user communities in which company engineers and executives often play active roles along with their customers. Among other things, group members make suggestions that often end up being included in the next software release for a particular radio. The folks at Flex Systems have now gone a step further, writing the software for the Flex 500 with open source computer code. Software savvy users are invited and encouraged not only to suggest new features, but to actually write software routines to make those features work. The code is then shared with other users who play with it, tweak it, try to break it, and generally make it even better than originally envisioned. Once it reaches a point of general acceptance, it often ends up in the next official software release for all Flex 5000 users. So far, though, most of those users appear to be programmers, downloading constantly updated developers' versions and happy to finally have found a place in Ham Radio where they can apply their considerable skills, too, advancing the radio art. They are also gaining invaluable experience in blending the digital world of software and computers with the analog world of RF transmission, reception, and propagation, skills that are in high demand and short supply. In a sidebar to our Flex 5000 review, Lee Crocker, called W9OY, says he feels that SDR represents such a paradigm of shift in amateur radio technology that all traditional radios are now obsolete. We are not ready to go along with that point of view just yet. There are many, many hams for whom clicking a mouse will never replace pushing buttons and turning dials. However, what we do feel represents a paradigm shift is opening up the development of radio operating software to the amateur community and making it a collaborative process. It has taken 25 years, but the software guys and gals we've been courting for so long finally have a home in ham radio where they can fully contribute to advancing the radio art. We welcome this change and encourage other manufacturers to consider following Flex's lead into the world of open source ham radio operating software. DEW2VU, Rich Mawson. Here's an interesting article, A Rookie's Guide to Contesting. The author is Brittany Decker, called KB1OGL, Kilo Bravo 1, Oscar Golf, Lima. It's nearly time again for the annual CQ Worldwide DX Contest, the world's most popular on-air competition. Normally, we hear from big gun stations or people operating in remote locations. So, for a change of pace this time around, we bring you 14-year-old KB1OGL's perspective and lessons learned as a newcomer to contesting. We particularly recommend it to the big guns. A commentary here from the editor of the magazine. On the surface, this article is about contesting, but on a deeper level, it is also about the importance of ham radio as a source of family time and about the extraordinary camaraderie of hams in general and contesters in particular. Now the article, A Rookie's Guide to Contesting by Brittany Decker, KB10GL. I fell in love with contesting almost as soon as I became a ham, stumbling onto a contest one night when I got on the air with my dad on the HF band. I was tuning around to see if I would be able to hear anything interesting. I then heard someone calling CQ Sweepstakes. Of course, I was puzzled by this, being new to the hobby. Because the man said sweepstakes, I assumed there must be some kind of raffle or lottery going on. My dad said I should participate, so I gave a call. The man gave me a number, so I took this to be my raffle number. Then he asked me for my number, and by that time I was utterly confused. My dad explained very quickly that it was a contest to see who can work the most people in a given amount of time, and the number I was given was my contest number. I finally understood the most basic meaning of contesting. However, there was a deeper meaning that I had not yet learned. Winter Field Day of 2007 was the first of its kind, sponsored by the Society for the Preservation of Amateur Radio, or SPAR. It was also my first planned contest operation. I couldn't stay awake for all of it, and I fell asleep at around midnight. My dad and I had not prepared much for it, but we had a good time and scored nicely in the end. We learned during this contest that when you log, you have to be well organized, unlike us and our paper log. We had a lot of trouble organizing the contacts, and we had also forgotten to write down the times of the contacts. After a couple of months, we finally got the information into the computer and got it all organized. For From that time on, we learned to use the computer logging software. Next came the ARRL, the ARRL January VHF contest. My dad and I decided to build an antenna and operate as a rover, R-O-V-E-R, from Ruggles Mine in Grafton, New Hampshire. When we got there, the gates were closed and it was snowing hard, so we decided to just park on an unplowed dirt road and operate from there. We set up the antenna on the back of the truck and called many people, but no one heard us. Our antenna also kept blowing down, and my dad had to go out into the cold, harsh weather to fix it. The wind was whipping, and the snow was coming down hard. After an hour or so, we called it quits and headed home without a single contact. My dad was disappointed, but I was quite happy. Being able to spend time with my dad, I also had fun because we got to drive out onto an unknown, unplowed dirt road, and I thought this was pretty adventurous. The next contest in store for me was the traditional ARRL field day of June 2007. It was my first field day, and I spent it with the Nashua Area Radio Club. When we arrived, the club set up in a bustling clearing. It was like a Chex mix, with two huge antennas and colorful tents surrounding them. The Salvation Army provided meals for the club, and the local communications department showed visitors their communications truck. My dad and I welcomed the visitors and informed them about amateur radio. We were also in charge of making 10-meter contacts. I also got to go to the 40-meter tent and practice high-speed contesting and logging. The practice that I got from logging really helped because I am not very good at logging. When I went back to my tent, my dad wanted me to keep making contacts on 10 meters, but I was too exhausted. So with the mosquitoes biting my face and buzzing my ears, I fell asleep right away. In the morning, the club members took down the huge antenna towers slowly and surely. If they had rushed, it would have been a lot more dangerous, but they took it slow, and everything was taken down safely. The next contest after field day was technically my second winter VHF contest, but since we made no contacts the first time, it really was my first. A ham operator who lived up the street from us, Bill Barber, called NE1B, invited my dad and me to operate the contest from his station. Our day was packed, as I was just getting back from one sleepover, and we had a scouting sleepover later that day. So we decided to operate for a couple of hours and help out Bill. When we arrived, we had some sodas with Bill, as well as Joe Charcia, called K1JC, and Dave Brindle, K1WER. Joe, the radio doctor, came over to give Bill a new radio and teach him a few tricks about it. Dave came to operate on 2 meters for the contest and logged the old-fashioned way on paper, but after the contest learned more about computer logging. We spent quite a while learning about the wonders of N1MM logging software. That's a call sign, November 1, Mike Mike. Software and how to use it. I operated on 6 meters, working mostly Florida and the area surrounding New Hampshire. I learned about the E layer of the ionosphere and how it can enable long-distance contacts over VHF, which is really very high frequency. I operated for about an hour and got about 40 contacts with just a few multipliers from Florida. When it was time to go, I had scored about 200 points. From this event, I learned that it is a lot more difficult to make contacts in a VHF contest than in one on the high-frequency RHF bands. I've already gotten used to pileups and contacts up to your ears. However, in a VHF contest, it's all about patience, perseverance, and precision. Also in January of 2008, my dad and I again participated in Winter Field Day. We have been planning for it ever since we participated in the first one the year before. In this contest, you earn 1,000 points for being outside, 1,000 for running on generator power, and 1,000 for being away from home. My dad and I decided that it was much too cold to be away from home, so we would run on a generator on the front porch with a small tarp tent and a heater. We've made mostly phone contacts, that's voice contacts, on 20 meters working hams as far away as Spain. Our working phone, we had fun alternating between operator and logger so that we would both be able to have lunch and dinner. After about 100 contacts on phone, we switched to slow scan television, making a single contact on that mode. We then switched to RTTY, that's radio teletype, and made two or three contacts in that mode. This was our first contest using modes other than phone, and also our first contest with a computer interface. During this contest, we faced many issues. Field A and Winter Field A are both designed in part to help amateurs identify the station's weaknesses. Last year's Winter Field A helped us realize we need a more organized log. This year, we faced many more challenges as we were outdoors. Since we were on a generator, we had multiple complaints of background noise coming into the microphone. The microphone would pick up the generator's hum and muffle out my voice. This, however, was something that could not be fixed for this contest, only learned from for the next one. Another challenge we faced was staying warm. Although our tarp retained a small amount of heat, I was fully dressed in a coat, warm clothes, and gloves to operate. I even brought out a blanket. My dad had to go back into the house multiple times to put on layer after layer of clothing. We were not the only ones who had trouble staying warm either. The laptop's mouse would not cooperate in cold weather. Whenever we tried to move the mouse, it went off in a totally opposite direction. Therefore, from this contest, we learned to minimize background noise and to keep not only your body, but your station warm as well. And now, entering the CQDX contest. The next contest in which I participated with my dad was the CQWPX single sideband contest in March 2008. I regret to say that I had never heard of it before. Rich, the editor of CQ, suggested that I work the contest and write a bit about it for this article. I didn't really know exactly what it was about, but I knew I had to find out. That Saturday, I had been running around at school in uncomfortable shoes to help with the musical sharing festival that was being held. I thought I would only stay to play piano for the chorus, but I ended up staying all day and got home at about 3 p.m. By that time, I was tired. I just wanted to sit and watch TV. But my dad was bugging me to get on the air for WPX. I dragged myself onto the air and started with the new software he installed that interfaced the computer and the radio together. I did not want to do this contest because I thought I knew which contests were great and which were boring. I thought this would be a very boring contest that no one would work. I was definitely wrong. I started with the search and pounce method, that's turning for and calling other stations calling CQ, and realize exactly how many people, not only in the United States, but all over the world, were working this contest. That got me into the contest spirit, and I took on the challenge. I spent a couple of hours on the air, then a couple of hours doing something else, and so on. It was a pretty relaxed contest, but our final score was about 240,000 points. After this, I was happy I had worked this contest. It was fun. However, after learning the purpose of it, to get different prefixes on the air, I was a bit disappointed. I had not heard anything too extraordinary that weekend, but I know I'll try again next year. Now, at the conclusion of this article, this contest has taught me that you must not judge a contest based on very little information or fatigue, but by how much enjoyment you get out of it. This is one of the best lessons I've learned from a contest, and I owe that to Rich. I've not been involved in nearly as many contests as some of the other hams out there, but I certainly have learned my fair share from each contest. From the time I participated in my first contest to now, I believe I have learned the true meaning of contesting. Although it is a lot of fun to see your name or call as the winner of a contest and receive some kind of award, the real joy of contesting is amateur radio itself. I realize that many people don't only get involved in contesting to win, but because they love amateur radio. Now that I know this, I know that this is the true reason I love contesting as well. That concludes a very nice article by Brittany Decker called KB1OGL Kilo Bravo 1 Oscar Golf Lima, titled A Rookie's Guide to Contest. And as I conclude this piece, I must give credit to the author's father, Kilo Golf 7 Hotel Foxtrot, KG7HF, who was all smiles as he worked the Winter Field Day contest. His photo appears at the beginning of the article on page 18. There's also a very fine full-color photograph of the shack where all the radios are set up. And to end it all, the author's 8-year-old brother Andrew listens and tries to keep warm while Brittany, who is pictured in the background of this picture, operates in the SPAR Winter Field Day contest. Very nice job, folks. Now, folks, on page 26 of CQ, October 2008, CQ Magazine reviews the Flex Radio Systems FLEX5000A, a software-defined radio transceiver. The author here is Neil Campbell, K3NC. I'm not actually going to read this CQ review for one basic reason. In digest form, this article spans about 8 pages, beautifully done, all kinds of illustrations, schematics, and screen information about the radio. It's a beautiful radio, but of course you have to know quite a bit about ham radio before you get into something like this. But I would take a look at it if you're into hamming, and if you're into software-defined information. It really looks impressive to me. Now, on page 34, near the end of this article, there's a little sidebar. It's titled User Perspective, Paradigm Shift by Lee Crocker, called W9OY. I recently was asked, is SDR ready for prime time? Let me answer that with some personal ham history. My first rig, Ambro transmitter, Hallicrafter's S40B receiver, and a Navy flameproof key. Paradigm Shift. I had 2 big iron boxes. Hallicrafters and Hammerlund. Paradigm Shift. Japanese companies entered the U.S. market with a wide variety of simple transceivers. My big iron went the way of the dodo. Transceivers made more sense, lighter, cheaper, even more features in ever smaller boxes. Next came transition rigs, part traditional transceiver and part proprietary SDR, software-defined radio. The latest paradigm shift, full SDR, has already occurred. SDR is of the present. The others, in my view, have become of the past. SDR is cheaper to build and more feature-packed. Old-time radios are basically etched in stone. Change is at the margins. Add a filter or two. Not much more. The SDR can be changed radically in form and function simply by changing the computer code. The SDR can be perfectly customized to your station's need, be it rag chewing, DXing, contesting, whatever. Upgrading involves a download, not a soldering iron. Entire radio fleets can be upgraded by simple downloads. Another paradigm shift, open source licensing. While others use proprietary code, Flex Radio freely promotes experimentation within the code among hams. Multiple branches of individually developed code reside on the Flex servers for download. As good ideas come to fruition, they are readily included into the main trunk of the SDR code, giving each owner a better radio experience. 100 enthusiast brains are far more creative than 1 factory engineer making all the decisions. It's a critical mass of hobbyist brain power, supercharging the future of our hobby. Freedom and flexibility. We are almost at the point of if you can think it, you can do it. These paradigm shifts are not future. The results sit on my desk today with performance that is as good as or better than anything else the market offers. Today, my desk holds only SDRs, radios that are not of the future. The paradigm shift has already occurred. There is a note at the bottom. The views expressed here are those of the author and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of CQ Magazine or its publishers, CQ Communications Incorporated. The author of this user perspective paradigm shift, Lee Crocker, C-R-O-C-K-E-R, is called W9OY. You can email him, lowercase, at L-E-E, underline, Crocker, at yahoo.com. Now, for the listener, as I move along the articles here, I come across Lights, Camera, Action, The Art and Science of Looking Your Best on SSTV, Slow Scan Television. The author here is Pete Kemp, K-E-N-P. Pete's call is KZ1Z, Kilo Zulu 1 Zulu. It's very colorful. It's quite lengthy. And if you're into slow scan television, you might want to get a copy of CQ Magazine if you're not a subscriber at one of the local bookstores, perhaps, or newsstands. Have one of your friends who might be a local ham share the information with you. Let's go now to a nostalgia piece, Radio Heroes. Each year we tell a story about radio heroes helping in an emergency situation. However, a ham's helping is not always during a natural disaster. It could be in times of war. While there are many stories of hams helping during wars, a recent book titled World War II, Radio Heroes, Letters of Compassion, by Lisa Spahr, S-P-A-H-R, describes the work of amateur radio operators and shortwave listeners who let family members know that their sons were captured by the German army, but more importantly, that they were alive and not missing in action. During World War II, there was a nightly program that aired on Radio Berlin called Calling Back Home. Each night, the program carried a list of names of prisoners of war, next of kin, and a short message from the captive soldiers. Many hams and shortwave listeners faithfully listened to these broadcasts, wrote down the information sent, and then sent a letter or postcard to the soldiers' relatives. The German army hoped that these broadcasts would send a message of doom and gloom to the families, and thus our country would become demoralized. Instead, it lifted the spirit of the families, knowing that the soldiers were alive. In some cases, the listeners sent out a lot of messages. Some actually developed a message template and filled in the blanks with the information from Radio Berlin. According to the book, in mid-1943, there were over 45 listeners. They were members of the Shortwave Amateur Monitors, that's SWAM. The organizer of the group, Mrs. Don Yant, Y-A-N-T, of Ohio, assigned several radio operators each night of the week to monitor the enemy radio station so that no POW family would go without notice. Yant also sent monthly newsletters to the members sharing radio news and techniques. Lisa Spahr shares her family story of how these radio listeners provided information about her grandfather, who had been captured. The book gives an insight into early amateur radio public service activity. Now, for further information about the book, you can go to www.powletters.com. That's www.powletters.com. Let's move along now to a reminder of the CQ LYDX single sideband contest. HF enthusiasts celebrate the arrival of the fall DX season. From October through November 2008, we will see a steady improvement in the DX bands. That's the long distance overseas from the United States bands. During the CQ Worldwide DX contest, single sideband the last full weekend of October, and CW, or Morse code, the last full weekend of November, we should experience fairly good conditions. So if you're a listener, even a shortwave listener, not yet a ham radio operator, if you have a radio capable of the long-distance bands, look around. You're going to find a lot of conversation out there from all over the world in different kinds of transmitting modes. Either Morse code, if you can read code, great. But if you just want to listen to voice, then listen to the regular phone contest. So as another reminder, CQ LYDX contest, a single sideband, is the last full weekend of October, And the CW Morse code portion is the last full weekend of November. Now, regarding contesting, there's a piece here by John Doerr, D-O-R-R. John's call is K1AR. First, a tip on the October's contests. Like me, when you operate a contest, everything goes exactly as planned, right? Unfortunately, that is rarely the case. The question is, what do you do with the information you learn during a contest? The most basic of tools is simply to keep notes. Whether it's a sticky rotator when beaming to the south or the call sign of a nice multiplier that moved around the bands for you, competitive advantage can be gained by capturing information that you'll undoubtedly forget later. Give it a try. You'll be amazed at how valuable your notes will be after the contest for the next time. So now we'll begin the article by John Doerr. Over the years, there has been considerable discussion about whether or not operating secrets truly exist in contesting. After all, it's only natural to assume that our experiences contribute to a basket of proprietary knowledge that only we know. Well, as a 40-year veteran of contesting, I'm here to report this month on the closest held secret of all. There are no secrets. I know that many of you disagree with the premise that secrets do not exist amongst the ranks of contest operators. Also, depending on your perspective, I will concede that there are some operating tips that can afford advantage over others. The point, however, is that they ultimately do not contribute to a sustainable way to one competitor beating another. For many reasons, I've always endorsed an open policy about my personal operating strategy, logs, and other pertinent information. Therefore, take a few minutes with an open mind and give the subject some thought. Are there really any secrets out there in contest land? Considering the topic of contesting secrets, one has to be careful to differentiate between the concept of circumstantial events and activities that are sustainable time and time again. Let me give you an example. Many years ago, while operating as a single operator on the CQRYDX-CW contest, I chose to try 40 meters at a ridiculously early time for the East Coast, something like noon. As I began turning the band, I noticed the European signals were fairly strong, which was unusual even by East Coast standards. A few of the U.S. multi-ops were calling CQ, and there was not a peer single operator to be found. Thus, I fired up on 7003 and called CQ, only to be rewarded with a swarming mass of callers. Much to my delight, I had discovered a band opening before most of my competitors, resulting in its being the pivotal operating decision of the weekend. To this day, my friends sometimes ask, AR, why did you go to 40 meters so early? My answer usually includes the fact that it was just a bit of intuition. Intuition is hardly the basis for claiming a closely held operating secret. Rather, it represents years of experience. Of course, with decades of operating stories to tell, I can share other examples as well. I remember countless times when I've discovered unusual band openings. For example, Southeast Asia booming in via the long path in the middle of the night on 20 meters. Or the HS0 on 10 meters when the band was otherwise dead. There were no secrets to that method of operating. Experience, however, has taught me that one of the keys to successful operating is to constantly search for the obscure band openings and opportunities that others may not consider. If you view that as a secret, then now you know. I prefer to think of it as one of the hundreds of operating decisions one makes in every contest. As technology has continued to infuse the world of contesting, we have become a more open contest society. And while I'll admit that in the early days of contesting, there may have been some closely guarded approaches to contest operating, the notion of secrets has totally evaporated as technology continues to expose many things that were previously hidden. In my view, this is good for contesting, whether it is open logs, such as the policy now being implemented by the CQ worldwide, or the potential of publicly available UB and slant LCR logging error reports, Openness makes the contest community at large a better group of operators. It certainly contributes to the position that operating secrets are non-existent. More importantly, it makes a wealth of experience available for all to learn from and better understand. There are other areas of operating strategy that often get confused with secrets. Here are just a few examples. Point: knowing which stations are more willing to move to other bands for you. Understanding more effective transmit frequencies to use on 40 and 75 meter single sideband. Maximizing the QSO, QSO potential from certain geographical areas around the world. Finding stations outside the contest that are willing to give you a contest QSO. Consistently making the right decisions about band choices. Knowing when to run versus search and pounce. Successfully applying a contrarian approach to operating. Trying operating tactics that few would otherwise consider. I accept the fact that many of you may view the above list to be premised on operating secrets. I prefer to think of the topics as being rooted in the core of operating strategy that is devised from years of experience. Maybe it's semantics, not my book. The bottom line, however, is that good operators at a well-engineered station are still going to win contests, and there will never be a substitute for hard work and lots of chair time. There is no magic pill or closely held group of secrets that will make a difference. It's easy to confuse the benefits of experience with the view that contest success is based on knowledge that others don't have. Fortunately, as with everything else in life, putting in your time pays rich dividends in contesting. There are no substitutes, and there are certainly no deep and dark secrets that will ever change that fact. What do you think? Now, as a final comment, I'll let you in on one secret. I'm out of time for this month. I encourage everyone to be more receptive about openness in contesting. In my view, the benefits clearly outweigh the downside. It's hard to believe the summer is behind us and we've entered yet another contest season. The CQ Worldwide Single Sideband is first up at the end of October, and I hope to work you many times this fall. See you in the next one. And it's signed, 73, John, K1AR. As I go forward with the magazine, I see that there is a special event station listed here. It's K1W from National Wildlife Refuge Week, the 105 years of service, Parker River NWR, Newburyport, Massachusetts, Pawtucket Radio Association. It's October 11 through 19. There are others listed, folks, but these other special event stations are all the first several days of October. And we're already right now sitting on October 3rd here in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, so there's no point me giving you that. This is the way they send the CQ magazine out. Apparently, it's only supposed to arrive on about the first day of the month of the issue of the magazine, which is fine, but I can't include some of these other special event stations in this broadcast. There are some hamfests, however, which are slated for October and early November, and they seem to fall into the time frame that you might be able to hear about them if you're interested in going to one of these swap meets, hamfests, call it what you want. First one, October 11, Bozeman Hamfest, Sagico Williams Middle School, Bozeman, Montana. October 10-11, NEAR, NEAR-Fest, the 4th, Deerfield Fairgrounds, Deerfield, New Hampshire. Same time frame, October 10-11, Paris, Texas Hamfest, Coliseum at Red River Valley Fairgrounds, Paris, Texas. October 12, Maysville Hamfest, Community Center, Maysville, North Carolina. October 12, Nutmeg Hamfest and ARRL Connecticut State Convention, Mountain Ridge Resort, Wallingford, Connecticut. October 19, RF Hill, ARC Hamfest, Sellersville Firehouse, Sellersville, Pennsylvania. Moving on in October, October 24 and 25, Texoma, that's T-E-X-O-M-A, Hammerama, Family Fun Fest, 08, Ardmore Convention Center, Ardmore, Oklahoma. October 26, Massillon, A-R-C, Hamfest and Auction, Massillon Boys and Girls Club Complex, Massillon, Ohio. Now, November 1, Enid, E-N-I-D, Enid Hamfest, Garfield County Fairgrounds, Hoover Building, Enid, Oklahoma. One more, November 7 and 9, Asia Pacific DX Convention, Osaka International House, Osaka, Japan. Let's go to Magic in the Sky by Jeff Reinhardt. Call Alpha Alpha 6 Juliet Romeo, AA 6 JR. This article is titled Advancements, Keeping the Dream Alive. In terms of advancements in technology, the last 100 years have been an astounding leap forward when compared with all of the history of civilization in the centuries and millennia prior. Consider what's occurred in terms of life expectancy, science, law, art, music, communications, education, and educational opportunities. In a quote I heard but can't accurately attribute, there was a statement along the line of all that is known by man, over 80% of that knowledge has been accumulated in the last 2 centuries. On the plus side, through the magic of internet and other resources, we now seem to have the world at our fingertips. Research that often took days or weeks frequently can be accomplished in seconds. Compare the sharing of knowledge today to that of 1908, when the primary medium was print and scientific research was shared through technical publications or one-to-one correspondence via the mail, which could take days or weeks to reach its destination. On a minus side, we've seen less in the way of screening information or outright attempts to manipulate or distort. I'm sure it's not a big secret to readers of CQ magazine that not everything you see on the internet is true. However, there are many others who do not understand that premise. What we know and how we share information is not a new concern. From Gutenberg's printing press, the invention of the 24-hour news cycle that was heralded by the arrival of the telegraph, through faster forms of travel, powered ship, rail, and aircraft, and finally, radio and TV, each advancement has been used for both good and evil. In other words, you can find both the best and worst in mankind using the same media or devices. Here's a quotation. When my brother and I built the first man-carrying flying machine, we thought that we were introducing into the world an invention which would make future wars practically impossible. That's attributed to Orville Wright. 1917. Now enter ham radio. When it comes to establishing and maintaining communications in a time of emergency, we, ham radio operators, are clearly the good guys. Try as they might, private industry has not been able to bump us off, and they have tried. No matter how many cell phones are sold, or commercial public safety repeaters are put in place, the billions of dollars invested by private industry have still not been able to equal a robust resilience of ham radio. This was again proven to me a few weeks ago on July 29. I was at a meeting in downtown Los Angeles when just before noon a moderate earthquake was felt. It was strong enough to get the attention of everyone present at the meeting. After the shaking stopped, out came the cell phones and, surprise, surprise, the system was not able to respond. Not funny, but funny. Wireless phones were similarly impacted. Now, this was only a moderate event, no major damage or injuries. So here we were in the center of the second most populated city in the nation, which one would presume is well served by a robust communications infrastructure, and the civilian communications system was overwhelmed in a matter of seconds. I can't imagine what chaos would have ensued if it had been a larger emergency. How would trapped or injured people get help? I don't like to brag, but I reached in my briefcase, pulled out a ham radio, was able to tune to some key repeaters, and had a fairly quick handle on the magnitude and epicenter of the event. Using the same radio, I was able to monitor public safety frequencies and determine that this was not a major emergency. There's an old saying that the most lethal weapon on the planet is a Marine and his rifle. Get a good rifle company of Marines and you have a serious force to contend with. I'll build on that by saying nothing can replace a cadre of experienced ham radio operators who are well-versed in using their own equipment, their training, and their ability to innovate. Give yourself extra points if you sharpen those skills by participating in field day, local ARIS, or racist drill conducted with public safety agencies, or even by conducting communications in support of community events. It all adds up to experience and knowing how to use your gear and communicate with others. When it comes to emergency responses, what private industry cannot replicate is our cellular abilities. We own and maintain our own equipment. We are scattered throughout the country or a region so that if one or some of us are impacted in a way that we cannot respond, others can easily take our place. We do not over-rely on fixed infrastructure. Even if a valued repeater goes down, we often can work around it. We're not dependent on local power sources. Through our field day activities and other drills, we know how to pull together generators, batteries, mobile units, even solar power if necessary. In a matter of a few hours or less, we can establish local and long-distance communications under adverse conditions. However, there's another bit of adversity we must overcome. Commercial providers have lured many government agencies into the false sense of security that their systems are all that is needed. For a price, of course. Also, those interests have something we do not, and that is very deep war chests that can be used to influence policy decisions. Don't get me wrong. I have nothing against commercial interests selling their radios and systems. I do get upset when they promise what cannot be delivered. We can only reply with a one-word response, Katrina, during which all the commercial systems collapsed and took considerable time to reestablish. In the meantime, hams were up and on the air almost as quickly as the wind died down. However, it will take more than that. Public safety agencies need to know who we are, what we're capable of, and that we can be depended upon. That doesn't happen overnight or through press releases. You have to be there during drills and community events to generate that sense of dependability. A quip from Woody Allen could provide some guidance. 80% of success is showing up. If I had to bet my ability to communicate against a storehouse of radios kept in some basement where they can be forgotten with neglected batteries, or lost as part of the emergency event, or having scattered in the same community a group of experienced ham operators with their own gear, I know which choice I would make. Thus, while technology may continue to advance into digital satellite or more exotic forms, not every advancement supplants older, effective, established methods. You can still go to a bookstore and return with a hardcover treasure. A bicycle is still both an effective workout and a fossil fuel saver. And ham radio will be ready to serve in the aftermath of the next emergency, provided you do your share to ensure it is ready. This inspiring article titled Advancements Keeping the Dream Alive is in the Magic in the Sky section by Jeff Reinhardt, R-E-I-N-H-A-R-D-T. Jeff's call is AA6JR, Alpha Alpha 6, Juliet Romeo. Thanks a lot, Jeff. Ladies and gentlemen, this brings me up to time for this digest format reading of CQ Magazine for October 2008. CQ, Amateur Radio Communications and Technology. The magazine is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. Your reader, my name is Bob Zeida, Z-E-I-D-A. My amateur radio call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. If you'd like to email me with comments about how I've read this material, aside from my crackly voice, which gets a little tired at 77 years of age, forgive me for that, you can send me an email at n1blf@comcast.net. That's n1blf@comcast.net. Now, this recording is provided by the Courage Handy Hemp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It's really for the use of eligible Handy Hemp members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Andy Hems may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. In our case, Handy Ham is always spelled lowercase, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M. That's one word, handyham@courage.org. The website, www.handyham.org. Thanks again for listening along with me. I'm located in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, right near good old Buzzards Bay and Cape Cod, 73.